operations against Israeli military sites and settlements deep inside the occupied territories, hitting a number of the regime's vital bases. The bases run by the Military Intelligence Division of the Israeli Army. The group also targeted the Estella Maris Naval Monitoring and Surveillance Base, northwest of Haifa, with a barrage of missiles. Earlier, the Lebanese resistance launched an aerial attack on the Eliakim base south of Haifa using drones, scoring a direct hit. Hezbollah also shot down an Israeli Hermes 450 drone with a surface-to-air missile. Several gathering points of Israeli forces in a number of settlements, including Yaron, Shalomi, Sasa, Kiryat Shemona, and Dishon, were also struck by Hezbollah's rockets. Now, to give you more insight on the matter, we are joined by Scott Ritter. He's a former U.S. Marine Intelligence officer from New York. Mr. Ritter, welcome to the program. I hope you're well. My first question, how do you assess the role of Hezbollah as a counterbalance to Israel's military presence in West Asia, especially considering the lack of substantial international intervention against Israeli actions?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that Hezbollah has been involved in a war of attrition, an escalating war of attrition with Israel from the very beginning of this crisis, soon after the October 7th 2023 attack on Israel by Hamas. And it has been the goal and objective of Hezbollah not to allow a major outbreak of fighting, that is a second front of full-scale warfare, to take place between Israel and Hezbollah, because that would distract from the primary purpose of supporting Hamas. And so everything needs to be couched in those terms. Hezbollah is not seeking to inflict the maximum harm on Israel. Hezbollah is seeking to maintain pressure against Israel, matching Israeli escalation with Hezbollah escalation, but it is escalation management. Hezbollah appears to be the only military power in the region besides Iran and Hamas, and I guess even Nasrallah, but that is the only one that's capable of matching Israeli escalation. The Israelis had tried to lead everybody to believe that they had neutralized Hezbollah by assassinating the Hezbollah leadership, by carrying out the terrorist attacks against Hezbollah members using pagers, and through extensive bombing campaigns, which Israel claimed successfully targeted Hezbollah's weapons storage and operational facilities. What we're seeing here with this attack by Hezbollah is proof positive that Hezbollah's capabilities have not been interdicted, that Hezbollah retains the ability not only to strike Israel, but to gather intelligence, to incorporate this intelligence, to pick targets carefully, and then to attack these targets. Hezbollah is far from defeated, and it appears that Hezbollah is more than capable of continuing this war of attrition, this escalating war of attrition.
That's right. Now, how effective has the Israeli military truly been in countering Hezbollah's recent retaliatory attacks? And do you see any limitations or vulnerabilities in Israel's defensive strategies that Hezbollah might be capitalizing on?
War is an extension of politics by other means. This is something that Karl von Clausewitz has put forward in his classic book on war. That means that we can't evaluate things based purely upon what's going on in the battlefield. We have to look at it from a political perspective. And here, Israel is unable to take its military capabilities and turn it into political victory. You know, one of the main reasons for the current Israeli escalation in Lebanon was to compel Hezbollah into a ceasefire that would allow Israel to return 60,000 of its settlers to the villages and towns in the north of Israel where they had been evacuated because of the ongoing conflict. As Hezbollah's most recent attacks show, not only is Israel unable to return the 60,000, but they're going to have to evacuate even more as Hezbollah begins this escalation. This is a devastating political failure that's brought about by the inability of the Israeli military to effectively intervene against Hezbollah. And we also see on the ground, Israel is not able to defeat Hezbollah in a stand-up fight on the ground. Hezbollah is able to carry out very effective defensive operations that are inflicting considerable casualties upon the Israelis. And lastly, we need to point out that the Israeli forces are not designed for, large-scale, long-term conflict, that the longer this conflict goes on, the less effective the Israeli military becomes. We already see a breakdown in morale on the part of the Israeli forces. Many are refusing to serve in Lebanon. Many are deserting. And tragically, because everybody is a human being, some are committing suicide rather than going back on duty. So we're seeing a breakdown in the effectiveness of the Israeli military the longer this conflict goes on. And that is, again, something that Hezbollah should be, the role of Hezbollah should be acknowledged. Hezbollah is able to carry out this conflict over a long period of time, survive the Israeli attacks, and continue to escalate, match Israeli escalation with their own capabilities.
That's right. Thank you so much for your insight and expertise. That was Scott Ritter, former U.S. Marine intelligence officer, joining us from New York.
Thanks for having me.
Now, the Israeli military presses ahead with its aggression against Lebanon, causing more civilian death and injuries in its latest attacks. According to Lebanon's health ministry, at least 30 people were killed and over 30 others injured in Israeli strikes on several towns in the country's eastern Bekaa region. Israeli airstrikes on Baalbek, also in the country's east, left over a dozen people dead, including members of the civil defense. To the south, nearly a dozen people were killed and over 20 others injured following Israeli air raids on villages near the city of Tyre. According to the Lebanese officials, Israel has been carrying out 113 airstrikes across Lebanon in the last 24 hours. The death toll from the Israeli aggression since October last year is now near 3,400. More than 14,400 others have been wounded. A new report by the World Bank says Israel's brutal aggression against Lebanon has inflicted huge economic and physical losses on the country since last October. The report put economic losses suffered by the country at more than $5 billion. It added that additional damage to physical structures also amounted to over $3 billion. According to the World Bank, nearly 100,000 housing units have been destroyed, mainly in Lebanon's south, and around 166,000 people have lost their jobs. It cited commerce, tourism, hospitality, and agriculture as the main sectors hit by Israel's aggression. The bank also estimated that the Israeli war on Lebanon will cut the country's real GDP growth for 2024 by at least 6.6%. The genocidal Israeli war on Gaza has claimed more civilian lives as the regime forces unleashed new strikes across the besieged strip. At least 4 Palestinians were killed in an airstrike that targeted a school sheltering displaced people in Gaza City. The deadly attack comes on the 41st day of the siege and relentless strikes on the northern part of the strip. The director of Kamal Adwan Hospital said homes of northern Gaza citizens have turned into their graves due to lack of rescue equipment to remove the debris and save those trapped. To the center of the besieged strip, 4 more people, including children, were killed after Israeli drones bombed a tent housing displaced people in Bereji refugee camp. According to Palestinian Health Ministry, the number of people killed in the Israeli deadly campaign since October the 7th last year has topped 43,700. More than 103,000 others have also been injured. Our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musabe joined us earlier with further details on the latest Israeli attacks across the besieged territory. Let's take a listen.
Let me begin with the northern part of Gaza Strip, which is still smoldering in light of the ongoing genocidal campaign targeting that area. Whereas over the past couple of hours, the Israeli occupation forces intensified their artillery shelling against Beit Lahia City, which is still suffering under this ongoing campaign targeting elsewhere in the northern part of Gaza Strip. The Israeli occupation forces are still intensifying their attacks against Beit Lahia City alongside Beit Hanun, in addition to Jabalia refugee camp. Those areas are still witnessing more artillery shelling. In addition to that, the Israeli troopers opened their gunfire towards the western part of Jabalia refugee camp. And as you know, the Israeli occupation forces carried out a destructive airstrike today against a gathering of the Palestinian people in the vicinity of Al-Omari Mosque there, killing at least 4 Palestinian civilians. In addition to that, multiple Palestinian casualties were reported after the Israeli occupation forces also carried out multiple attacks against the eastern part of Jabalia refugee camp. So the kind of situation is still agonizing for the Palestinian people who are still staying there in the northern part of Gaza. So they are still suffering for more than 40 consecutive days. They are still subjected to cruel Israeli airstrikes and attacks, and on the ground they are still being starved by the Israeli occupation forces, who are still imposing their suffocating siege against that area, preventing any entry of the significant amounts of the humanitarian supplies for the people there.
The U.S.-Israeli genocide continues unabated in Gaza, bringing much of the territory's vital infrastructure to its knees. That includes water resources of the coastal silver. The Gaza municipality said in a harrowing revelation that the Israeli military has destroyed over 105,000 water lines and 70% of the territory's water wells. It added that the limited capabilities of the municipality hinder its ability to solve the crisis, forcing citizens to transport water manually to their homes. The municipality noted that there has been a sharp rise in clean water prices due to increased cost of fuel, further exacerbating the suffering of Gaza citizens. The Israeli aggression against Gaza began last October. The regime has been working to destroy all aspects of life in Gaza since then. Israeli forces continued their violent raids on Palestinian cities and towns across the occupied West Bank during their latest incursions. Two Palestinian miners sustained injuries from the regime's forces' live fire in the Beit Furik town, east of Nablus. Israeli troops also shot and wounded two other miners in the town of Sinjil, north of Ramallah. Our Ramallah correspondent Naga Hamid joined us earlier with the latest updates. Let's take a listen.
Incursions have increased actually over here in the West Bank. For today we are talking about an incursion that has been done to Sinjil, to Kinkaret, to Jenin, Al-Khalil. Most of the Palestinians' main city were under raids today. In Sinjil specifically, two Palestinian youths have occurred gunshot wounds from the IOF while being in their village. They are with it both shot. They were both 15 years old youth shot in their legs, and later they were taken to a hospital, a nearby hospital. Also in the area of Tul Kerem and Jenin and Qalqilia, many raids and incursions have been done to these cities. And as the IOF always says, under the pretense of pursuing resistance-related Palestinians or resistance fighters, wanted resistance fighters in these areas. Well, the main headline today over here in the West Bank was not only these incursions, but was the increasing road closures and the hardships that Palestinians have been facing over here, at least for the last month. And of course, since the beginning of the genocide in Gaza.
Yemen's Ansarullah leader has slammed the U.S. as complicit in Israeli crimes in Gaza and Lebanon, saying the American weapons are enabling and fueling the wars of extermination in the region.
The Israeli criminality, the Israeli tyranny is at its peak. They are committing crimes of genocide. They are prohibiting any medicine and food to reach the Palestinian people. They're destroying the cities and the towns and the villages in the Gaza Strip almost completely and entirely. The American is a partner with the Israelis in all of this. And they allow, the U.S. allows all these bombs, they give it all these bombs to allow them to kill women and children in Palestine, and they kill the people of Lebanon as well.
Abdul Malik al-Houthi said Israel's presence and practices in the region pose a serious threat to the Islamic nation's freedom and independence. The Yemeni leader once again condemned certain Arab nations for their increased cooperation and trade with Israel. He has stressed such unconditional support would not bring them security or stability in the face of the regime's regional expansionist project. Houthi also hailed the resistance fighters' resilience against Israel, saying their numerous operations have inflicted heavy losses on the invading IOF troops in Gaza and Lebanon. The Ansarullah leader also vowed Yemen will continue its military operations in support of Lebanon and Palestine, calling such backing a religious and humanitarian duty. Ali Larijani, a senior advisor to Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, visited Damascus on Thursday at the head of the high-level delegation. His meeting with Syria's President Bashar al-Assad comes as Syria reiterated its firm commitment to the regional resistance at the recent Islamic summit in Riyadh. This is while Israeli aggression in the region has been on rise with the unconditional U.S. support, Ibrahim Bahti reports from Damascus.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad met on Thursday with Ali Larijani, a senior advisor of Iran's leader. During the meeting, both parties discussed bilateral relations and developments in the region. Assad reaffirmed Syria's support for the Palestinian and Lebanese people, while Larijani stressed that Iran will always provide all necessary measures to support Syria and the resistance, highlighting the fundamental role of Damascus in the region.
I reiterated during my meeting with President Assad the need to support the struggle of the axis of resistance, because resistance is the path to victory as it is also the path of dignity for all Muslims. With God's blessing, the resistance will achieve victory and we will continue our support for the resistance.
Larijani also met with the Palestinian resistance factions in Syria and discussed with their leaders the means to consolidate with the Palestinian people in Gaza and the West Bank, reiterating Tehran's firm support for the struggle of the Palestinian people and resistance.
The Islamic Republic of Iran spares no effort to support the resistance. Without Iran's support, our people would not have shown this strength against this criminal enemy for more than 400 days. Mr. Ali Larijani consulted with us on ways to consolidate the strength of the resistance.
The meetings that Ali Larijani held with the Syrian president and the Palestinian leaders have reinforced the strong alliance between Iran and Syria, as well as the resistance factions.
Larijani's visit to Syria highlights the ever-deepening alliance between Syria and Iran, as both nations prepare to tackle regional challenges and bolster their coordinated stance in the face of ongoing threats. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Take care and bye-bye.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remember the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
In the Limelight.
It is naive to think that the change of government in the U.S. will bring any changes for the aggressed countries, since any ceasefire or temporary cessation of hostilities is not the solution to the chronic question of the Zionist occupation of or the dangers to the region posed by illegitimate Israel. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Kahan International wrote, "The Organization of Islamic Cooperation, OIC, in its summit in Riyadh, has called for immediate end to the Zionist entity's aggression on Gaza, in occupied Palestine, and on Lebanon. However, the billion, not million dollar question is, will the war criminals in Tel Aviv, with their insatiable thirst for Arab blood, heed it? The answer is obvious, and cheaper than a dime, in sharp contrast to the very expensive question. Forget the multi-trillion dollar worthless reserves of the wealthy Arab states. The incessant but ineffective denunciations of the Gaza genocide, now in its 14th month, by the 57 OIC member states, or the combined strength of their armies numbering several powerless millions." Usurper Israel, it's a slaughter of the innocents, blindly backed by the weapons and wealth of the criminal regimes marching in and out of that black edifice in Washington, mistakenly called the White House, has no intention of stopping the genocide, which it is now spreading to other parts of the Levant, as is evident by its frequent attacks on Syria. The plea to hold the Zionist aggression was only a draft declaration of the Monday meeting in Riyadh. It was not the final communique, neither a statement of the joint OIC Arab League session, nor the endorsement of such releases by the equally impotent United Nations. The illegal Zionist entity, the demands of whose expulsion from the world body for its increasing crimes against humanity fall on deaf ears, is criminally confident of continuing its terrorism in Palestine, Lebanon, Syria and Yemen, and if possible against Iraq and Iran. All this proves the uselessness of diplomacy vis-à-vis the devilish design of destruction of countries, coupled with threats to assassinate leaders, such as President Bashar al-Assad, if Syrian territory parts under U.S. occupation with full access for Israel's illegal use, found as transit route for equipment passing to Lebanon's legendary anti-terrorist movement, the Hezbollah. Thus, diplomacy, which has already been exhausted, will not end the daily bombing of Gaza and Lebanon, as well as the stopping up of raids on Syria, the US-UK aerial attacks on Yemen, or for that matter, the evil designs against Iraq and Iran. What the OIC as a whole and its members as individuals need to do is not just casually discuss ways to provide much-needed effective weapons to the resistance fighters in Palestine, Lebanon and Syria, but to take practical steps for urgent military measures. This includes the legitimate action of direct attacks on the illegal Zionist entity, no matter if the Americans and the British feel averse. It is naive to think that the change of government in the United States of America will bring any changes for the aggressed countries. since any ceasefire or temporary cessation of hostilities is not the solution to the chronic question of the Zionist occupation of or the dangers to the region posed by illegitimate Israel.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, love of the world. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Sister Zainab on A to Z, speaking to you today about love of the world. Now, love of the world is something that affects all of us as Muslims. Of course, it affects non-Muslims as well. But as Muslims, we are particularly focused or concerned about this because there's particular issues arising from love of the world, which means love of our worldly life, love of material things, including children, including everything we own in this world, including our job, our status, certificates, whatever rank we have, whatever profession we have. Because there are particular things that can happen if we don't address this, if we're not able to divest ourselves, in a sense, of this tendency to become really attached to these things. So something interesting I read is that, for example, if we are found to have this particular issue after this life, of course, but before we enter the hereafter, we have this period in Barzakh. Now, what happens is that if we're found to still leave this world, if our soul leaves this worldly life with this love for the world in it, and, you know, and we've got our possessions and so on piled up literally as we're leaving this world, maybe, lengthens our period in Barzakh and intensifies it. Now, you can imagine the Barzakh is not an easy time. So the idea is that, so if we want to make it as easy, as tolerable as possible for us, because obviously this is a very confined space that we have. And so imagine to yourself, and some people obviously practice this, they actually lie down in the space where obviously a person is going to be buried, just to see how really is it, how narrow is it, how limiting is it, how confined are we there. And so obviously it means that if we have these things in our heart, if our soul has these, that space is going to feel even narrower. And the length that we have to spend in this confined space gets extended. And obviously you can imagine as we go through our life and as we are nearing death, typically what is said is that people who have a love of this world fear death anyway. And of course, because we've been piling up all these things, we've been enjoying this world, thinking this world is everything. So, but let's think about that. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio, and I'm talking about obviously what happens when we go through life and we have this big love for the world. For example, the fact that we tend to then fear death, whereas people who have detached themselves from worldly things, when you speak to them, you do get this sense that they have no fear of death. And obviously we've seen recently, and we've seen throughout recent history, people who, for example, live in regions in which they've been under occupation, they've had to deal with oppression, they've maybe have had their belongings, their houses, everything bombed, they've lost family members. So they, obviously, they they must detach themselves because these things have been destroyed and taken from them anyway. But these people have no fear of death. They understand what is of value is the hereafter. And something interesting also that I read is that if we want to get into the one of the higher levels in paradise, one of the highest heavens, we need to actually have strength of willpower. And this is actually written, reported as a criterion of entry into one of the highest heavens. And you can imagine, so if we develop willpower, which we need for many things anyway, but if we have this willpower, that will also make it that much easier to, in a sense, detach from everything in this life anyway. And there's traditions or narrations that tell us, for example, that whoever makes this world their biggest concern, God will put poverty into that person's eyes. And something that is really dangerous, this also means that the human being will be deprived of his faith. And also that all the affairs of that person in this world can be made a mess. Now, just think to yourself, try and imagine people who in your eyes have no faith. Let's just think of certain oppressors in the world. And we know that at this point in time, there are huge oppressors in the world, and they really seem to be living in a gigantic mess. So bear this in mind. These are just some thoughts for you. And inshallah, you've gained some insight from this. And fear man Allah. And I look forward to speaking to you again on Iran Radio with A to Z. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's banning of UNRWA should represent an opportunity for those concerned about the standing of the United Nations to remind Israel that UN members who have no respect for international law deserve to be delegitimized. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, on October 28, the Israeli Knesset passed a second reading of two bills that effectively ban the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, from carrying out any activity in Israel and occupy Palestine. Simply put, the decision is catastrophic because UNRWA is the main international body responsible for the welfare of millions of Palestinians throughout the occupied territories and throughout much of the region. The Zionist regime followed its decision by attacking and damaging an UNRWA office in Nur Shams refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. It was the Zionist regime government's way of demonstrating its seriousness regarding the matter. This is not the first time that Israel has pursued an anti-UNRWA agenda and, contrary to claims by the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other Israeli regime officials, the decision is not linked to the current genocidal war on Gaza or the unfounded claims that UNRWA supports terrorism. An independent review commissioned by the UN revealed that Israel made public claims that a significant number of UNRWA employees are members of terrorist organizations, but that it has yet to provide supporting evidence of this. The Zionist regime claims, however, did a great deal of damage to the organization. At 13 countries, including the United States, Canada, Australia, Britain, Germany, and Italy, withheld badly needed funds that were helping Gaza stave off a horrific famine. Eventually, most of these countries reinstated their financial support, though without apologizing to the Palestinians who were adversely impacted by these countries' initial unfair decision. On repenting, the Zionist regime continued to unleash its relentless war on the organization. UNRWA workers involved in terrorist activities against Israel must be held accountable, Netanyahu claimed in a statement on October 28. The anti-UNRWA rhetoric remains functional for the Israeli regime. Amplified by the ever-willing U.S. mainstream media, the Zionist regime has managed to keep UNRWA's name in the news, always associating it with supporting terrorism. So, when the Israeli Knesset voted for the anti-UNRWA bills, mainstream media conveyed the news as if they were the only rational conclusion to an essentially fabricated story. The Zionist regime problem with UNRWA has little to do with the organization itself, but with its underlying political representation as a UN entity whose mission is predicated on providing assistance and protection to Palestine refugees. UNRWA was established in 1949 by the UN General Assembly Resolution 302. It began its operations on May 1, 1950, and with time, it became central to the survival of a large number of Palestinian refugee communities in Gaza, the West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. Many have rightly criticized the UN for failing to supplement UNRWA's humanitarian mandate with a political equivalent that would ultimately help Palestinians achieve their right of return in accordance with UN Resolution 194. For Israel, however, UNRWA remained problematic. According to Tel Aviv's thinking, UNRWA's existence is a constant reminder that there is a distinct group of people called Palestinian refugees. And though UNRWA is not a political organization, the Palestinian refugee crisis and all related UN resolutions that emphasize the inalienable rights of these refugees are very political. Taking advantage of the initial, albeit brief, sympathy with the Zionist regime worldwide and the massive campaign of misinformation emanating from Israel and its allies, Netanyahu used October 7 as an opportunity to further demonize UNRWA. However, his campaign had started much earlier. A key player in the war on UNRWA was Jared Kushner, son-in-law of U.S. President Donald Trump. Kushner, who invested much time in helping the Zionist regime defeat the Palestinians once and for all, made UNRWA a key point in his plan. He vowed to carry out sincere effort to disrupt the work of the organization, a leaked email revealed. Due to international rejection and solidarity, Kushner ultimately failed. Even the withholding of funds by the U.S. administration did not force the organization to shut down, although it did negatively impact the lives of millions of Palestinians. The ongoing war on Gaza and the push to annex large parts of the West Bank represented a golden opportunity for Netanyahu and his extremist government to increase the pressure on UNRWA. They have been enabled by unconditional U.S. support and the willingness of various Western regimes to recklessly act upon Israel's false claims regarding the UN resolution. By allowing the Zionist regime to delegitimize the very organization responsible for enforcing international law, the UN's crisis becomes much deeper. The impassioned plea on October 30 by UN Special Rapporteur Francisca Albanese reflects the frustration felt by many UN-affiliated officials regarding the growing irrelevance of the UN. In her speech, Albanese pointed out that if the UN's failures continue, its impact will become even more and more irrelevant to the rest of the world, especially during these times of turmoil. This irrelevance is already being felt by millions of Palestinians, mainly in Gaza, but also in the West Bank. Though Palestinians continue to withstand and reject and resist Israeli regime aggression, they are fed up with an international system that seems to offer them only words but little action. The Zionist regime's banning of UNRWA should represent an opportunity for those concerned about the standing of the United Nations to remind Israel that UN members who have no respect for international law deserve to be delegitimized. This time, words must be accompanied by action. Nothing else will suffice.
Nightmare of Jerusalem. Part 4.
April 10th, 2024. These are American F-35 fighter jets. The runway they take off from is in Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories, and today, these jets belong to the Israeli regime. These fighters fly in a situation where the U.S. government has banned Israel from any response to Iran's April 13th military operation launched a few days earlier. However, Israel cannot forego responding to the attack. Israel's response means survival, and failure to respond means the rapid annihilation of the regime.
We don't seek a wider war in the region. We don't seek a war with Iran.
So if Israel wants a war with Iran, it's going to find itself alone in that conflict.
The U.S. has agreed to a limited response, so these fighters fly with minimal coordination with the U.S. to deliver a crushing response to Israel's arch foe and its biggest enemy in history, the Islamic Republic of Iran. For 6 months, Israel had been pounding Gaza with the heaviest shelling in human history following the retaliatory operation by the Al-Qassam Brigades of the people of Gaza on the occupied territories on the 7th of October.
Quite literally, every day I was there, I saw a child shot in the head. That's not an accident. That's deliberate targeting of children for death. That's murder.
On that fateful day, the regime faced a significant security scandal. To cover it up, it committed a major crime on a massive scale before the eyes of the world. More than 100,000 people in Gaza were killed or injured. The Gaza Strip is the most densely populated geographical area in the world and houses over 2 million people. It means Israel has either killed or seriously injured a 20th of the Gaza population. The West is, however, silent about the genocide.
I mean, look at this. There's nothing I can say that does more justice than the pictures themselves. And it's impossible to know whether this kind of level of destruction was militarily necessary or whether it's some scorched earth policy. But surely, if there is ever a ceasefire here, this is going to take decades to rebuild.
Analysts believe the killings are part of Israel's strategy to create deterrence. For more than 50 years, the Israeli regime has confronted any kind of attack and even potential threats in the strongest possible way to achieve sustainability. On June 5, 1967, at the height of the Gamal Abdel Nasser's verbal attacks, Israel immediately attacked Egypt and destroyed all the country's airports. Abdel Nasser was the leader of the revolutionaries of the Arab world. In this war, Gaza was separated from Egypt, and the main branch of the vital rivers of Jordan was taken from the kingdom by force of arms. Israel also separated the Golan Heights from Syria to dominate the sensitive areas of its neighboring countries. Israeli planes were preparing to invade Iran, while Israeli pilots, who had read about their victories in school textbooks, were always told stories about invincible Israel. An Israel that shows no mercy in the face of any aggression and responds in the harshest possible way. April 19, 2024. The fighter jets, equipped with the highest technology in the world, are scheduled to fly towards Iran. Rumors suggest that they practiced refueling for a week in Iraq's airspace. No one knows how severe the attack is going to be. Israel's always been the aggressor, and this time responding to an attack that is not palatable to the regime leaders. Iran launched an attack. In an astonishing show, the firing of the missiles and drones was synchronized in a way so they would reach the occupied territories simultaneously. At 1:20 a.m., the exact time when the commander of Iran's Quds Force was assassinated by the American army, and Iran is seeking to punish the perpetrators, Israel is forced to attack secretly. Maybe something like the Battle of Karameh on March 21, 1968. On the morning of March 21, 1968, the Israeli army tanks crossed the Jordan River and invaded Jordanian territory. Israeli paratroopers landed around Arafat's headquarters. Jordan lacked a proper defense system to confront the regime. The Jordanian artillery responded to the tanks, but the Israeli Air Force leveled the entire area of Karameh, Jordan. Although Israel could not kill Arafat, it demonstrated it would respond to stones with bombs. On June 27, 1967, Israel faced a specific invasion. In this event, a passenger plane with 300 passengers took off from Ben Gurion Airport in the occupied territories, but the plane did not land in Paris as was scheduled. The plane landed in Greece for refueling, and some members of the Palestinian resistance movements boarded and hijacked it. The flight was successfully diverted to Uganda. Hijacking was one side of the crisis. The other was a destination, Uganda. The Ugandan dictator, once a supporter of Israel, had expelled all Israeli diplomats when he did not receive military support from the regime during a war with his neighbor. Idi Amin, now an enemy of Israel, used the hijacking in the media to humiliate Israel. The plane with Israeli passengers landed on the runway of Entebbe Airport in Uganda, unraveling a new chapter in the Israeli regime's deterrence strategy. The plane reached Entebbe and the engines were turned off on the runway. 3 days later, the regime was in a deeper crisis than before. Ehud Barak, head of the army, held a meeting with officials and decided to free the captives and teach Uganda a lesson. Barak was certain that diplomacy would not work, and even if it did, Israel's main strategy for deterrence is to flex its muscles. A complex operation was planned. Colonel Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu's brother, was responsible for executing the operation on the ground. After gathering information from the released passengers, intelligence officers traveled to France to learn about the plane's condition and how to handle it at Entebbe Airport. The passengers were released as a goodwill gesture through Ugandan mediation, but Netanyahu did not want Uganda to have a positive memory of this incident. Israel built a real-sized replica of the Entebbe Airport in the Negev Desert. The airport was completed by Israeli companies, and the regime already had information about it. Rigorous military exercises were carried out on the replica, and finally, on the scheduled night, the order to attack the airport was issued through a wireless message to Sayeret Matkal military unit forces. The regime's army forces released the captives. Colonel Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu's older brother, was killed in the attack. But Israel destroyed all Ugandan fighter jets on the runways. The attack left 35 Ugandans dead and destroyed its air force. April 19, 2024. Now, the younger brother of the commander of the operation, Benjamin Netanyahu, is the Prime Minister of Israel. But Netanyahu is in a tight spot. Street protests against him have been snowballing all over occupied territories for a year. And the Hamas movement has given a significant security shock to the regime with an operation by its fighters. In the northern parts of occupied territories, Hezbollah is attacking Israeli spy radars and turrets dauntlessly. Under these circumstances, Iran has attacked Israel with an army of boisterous drones. Like a TV show, the drones paraded before the eyes of the Arab world until they reached Israeli-occupied territories and then rockets rained down. Negev witnessed the landing of fragmentation warheads of Iranian missiles. In the few leaked images, some warheads changed direction and dived on the anti-ballistic system. Israel faced the biggest attack in its history since the war with the Arabs, and there's no mention of the Iron Dome. The regime was somehow lucky Iran only intended to punish it. Otherwise, if the missiles had continued to rain down, it would have exhausted the anti-missile system magazine, and every missile would be a great achievement for Iran that could create hell for Israel, so it would lose its chance to retaliate and meet its ultimate fate, namely annihilation. But this was not the only defeat the regime suffered. Netanyahu miscalculated Iran's retaliatory move, leading to the targeting of the Iranian consulate in Syria with a missile. The incident ended Iran's strategic patience, and the military attack was a direct result of Netanyahu's own actions. Iran had only used its very old drones and missiles, while Israel had brought all its military power to the field. Not only Israel, but all NATO and Arab League in the West Asian region.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing. Well, in this program, we answer your queries and questions and we discuss very important topics on Islamic upbringing of your children. Our answers are rooted in the Holy Book of Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today we have had the pleasure to be with Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum, sister.
A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you so much.
So, dear listeners, Brother Liaqat is really interested in conducting research in the fields of Islamic history, psychology, and philosophy. And currently, he's pursuing a master's degree in Islamic psychology at Jamiat al-Mustafa Institute of Islamic and Social Sciences. Well, Brother Liaqat, again, a very warm welcome.
Thank you so much, sister.
So we are glad to be with you again. And we have been discussing some very beautiful examples from the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. Especially you gave us also the examples of nurturing, how parents had nurtured their children and how they stood in Karbala for the imam of their time, and how we can nurture our children again so that they can be there for the imam of their time. So yes, brother, today we would want to know more from you.
Thank you so much. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. So on the day of Ashura, the day of lessons, it's not just an incident in the history. There are thousands and thousands of lessons what we can learn with regards to upbringing. There are many more what we can see, like with regards to political aspect, with regards to like other like economical aspect.
Hijab.
Seeing Ashura from an economical aspect as well.
Right.
Of course, this is not my topic again. And with regards to upbringing, so Ashura has a lot of dimensions. If we go to see, and one of the dimension is upbringing. So going ahead, I was talking about the teenagers on the day of Ashura and their upbringing from the elders, how they brought up their teens. So one is Hazrat Ali Akbar alayhi salatu wasalam, whom we see, and also like